Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Just before we start this hour of the show, I want to recap a little bit of the weather information that we have this morning, just to make sure that you're up to date here, because there are a number of warnings that have been issued. There is a winter storm warning that has been issued for today for much of northern Illinois and Indiana. That includes Ford County, within the severe weather coverage area. And then just a little while ago, a winter storm warning also added for Champaign County, and that will be in effect until 6 o'clock on Thursday morning. There was also an ice storm warning until 6 tonight for parts of central Indiana, and a flood warning for Coles, Douglas, Edgar, and Shelby counties in east central Illinois. Here for Champaign-Urbana, we're expecting for this afternoon we'll have a mixture of freezing rain and sleet, and as much as a half inch of ice accumulation. Then for tonight, we'll continue with that freezing rain, sleet, snow, changing to all snow before ending after midnight. We're expecting a possibility of 1 to 2 inches total accumulation. And because of the weather, we have some closings we want to announce. The St. Joseph School District will be closing early today as follows. Prairie View Grade School, St. Joe Grade School, and St. Joe Ogden High will dismiss at 1. And the Ogden Grade School will dismiss at 1:10. In Monticello, the schools will dismiss early today as follows. White Heath at 1:05. Lincoln, Washington, and the high school at 1:15. Monticello Middle School dismisses at 1:25. St. Matthew Lutheran School in Urbana has canceled all evening activities. And also in Rantoul, St. Malachy is also going to be dismissing early. And I think that's also at 11:30. Rantoul High School will also dismiss at 11:30, and St. Malachy in Rantoul will also dismiss. Okay, so that's what we have right now, and I expect there's going to be more, and we will do our best to keep you informed of what's going on with the weather, and for sure we'll have an update for you as part of the afternoon magazine at 12:35 this afternoon. Well, with that, we say good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of the program, we will be talking about the rise and fall of Lucent Technologies. This is a company that was spun off from AT&T. It was born in April of 1996. At the time, it was the largest ever IPO. Also, at one time, it was the most widely held stock in America. However, things for Lucent turned around pretty quickly, and in less than 2 years, the stock lost 99% of its value. The question we'll explore this morning is, how is it that a financially sound company, one that was dominant in one of the fastest-growing industries, declined so far so fast? And our guest for the program is Lisa Endlich. She is the author of a recently published book, actually it's been out for a couple of months now, titled Optical Illusions, Lucent and the Crash of Telecom. It's published by Simon & Schuster. She's former vice president and foreign exchange trader for the investment firm Goldman Sachs. She has master's degrees from MIT in management and urban planning. She's also written a book about Goldman Sachs titled The Culture of Success. She is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you certainly are welcome to call. Ms. Endlich, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me this morning.
We certainly appreciate it. Perhaps before talking about what happened here with Lucent, it might be a good idea to, as a way of setting the stage, to talk about the time at which Lucent was created, to talk a little bit about what was going on in telecommunications at that time, in 1996.
Sure. As you mentioned, Lucent was a spinoff from AT&T, and as AT&T is and was one of the most widely held stocks in America, Lucent then became, at one time, the most widely held stock in America. Just to give you some sense of how many people own this stock, Lucent had 4.7 million shareholders. In other words, 1 in 10 of every Americans who owned stock owned Lucent. So the effects of what happened to Lucent were certainly wide-reaching all over the United States. 1996 was a very interesting moment for telecommunications. There were three events that happened sort of simultaneously that affected the industry. One was it was the height of the turnover from the old analog systems with copper wires to the digital systems with fiber optic cable. So that was a process that was going on and was really being accelerated into the late 1990s. The second important thing that was happening when Lucent was spun off was the Y2K furor. As you remember, people were very, very rapidly trying to upgrade their systems so that we didn't have a big crash in the telecommunication systems with the turn of the millennium. So there was an enormous amount of investment in telecommunications that was being put into place in the run-up to the millennium. And the third and perhaps most important thing for Lucent was in 1996, the U.S. government deregulated the communications industry. And this is very much as they had done, let's say, in the airline industry earlier, in which any number of players could now come into the industry, start small telecom companies, and take on the baby bells, which really had dominated the U.S. telecom market for the whole of the 20th century. And for Lucent, this meant that Lucent went from having basically eight main customers, AT&T and the baby bells, to having almost 800 customers. Mm. And so, these small companies that started up after 1996.
So that you would think a company like this that was in the business of providing telecommunications equipment would be poised now for just explosive growth, because suddenly there are all of these startup companies that are trying to build their networks and they're going to want to buy equipment, and this would be the main place, probably the main and number one and first place that they would think of going to buy all this stuff.
That's exactly what happened. Lucent stock went up tenfold. So, you know, if you bought the stock for, $4, you were looking, or about $8, I'm sorry, when it was initially floated, you were looking at a very, very tidy profit in a very short period of time, because all these new customers, as you mentioned, needed to set up their own telecommunications infrastructure, and Lucent, Cisco, JDS Uniphase, places like that, they went to buy this stuff. So Lucent had a boon in their industry that no one at the point of IPO, at the point at which Lucent was spun off, could have anticipated was available to them.
Yeah. How is it, maybe again we take a step back and talk a little bit about how it is that Lucent, and essentially what we're talking about is this is Bell Labs and Western Electric, the manufacturing, the research and manufacturing arms of AT&T, how it is they happen to be spun off from AT&T, how that happened. And I guess my understanding is, again, from looking at the book, that at least some people in the management of AT&T did not want to let go of them.
Yes, it was quite controversial. Basically, we need to look back to 1982 for a moment to give the reasons for the spinoff. In 1982, the government separated long-distance telecommunications from local telecommunications. So the once monolithic AT&T that ran every aspect of our communications in the United States, from the handset that you and I are holding, you know, through the wires to the exchange, through the entire system, was split apart in 1982 by government order, and we had the baby bells. So we had the 9Xs and the Pacific Telephones and that of the world, and they had the local distance, local communications. Now, what didn't change was that Lucent, then part of AT&T, was the equipment provider for both the long distance carriers and the local carriers. Now, over the course of the 1980s and into the 1990s, AT&T was getting into the local market, AT&T was getting into the cellular market, the local carriers were getting into the long-distance market. Verizon now provides, here in New York, provides long-distance services as well as cellular service. So imagine, you're the equipment arm of AT&T, and you're selling to both AT&T and to AT&T's competitors. This is obviously an untenable situation. The local carriers had no interest. The local carriers, as well as MCI and Sprint, had no interest in buying their equipment from AT&T, their prime competitor. So the system, as it was created in 1982, was bound to fail, and it did. People turned away. They bought equipment from Nortel, the Canadian competitor. They bought equipment from Alcatel, the French competitor. And AT&T's market share began to erode, and AT&T realized they needed to do something. And it was at that point that they decided to spin off Lucent. as a newly formed company that would have, as you mentioned, Bell Labs, the sort of brain trust of the telecommunications industry, and the equipment division of AT&T, and it became a separate company in 1996.
Yeah. Well, as we've talked about, because of the deregulation in the telecommunications industry in 96, the fact that we had all these startups, you would think that Lucent would be well-positioned because it could provide the equipment that all of these companies would need to start. On the other hand, I suppose some people might just take a look at these units, at Bell Labs, at the manufacturing arms of AT&T, and ask this question, well, did it really, though? You'd think on paper this looks good, but you might also have to ask, did it really make sense to make a company, to take those pieces and to put them together and make a company out of them?
I think it did, by and large. I think, by and large, it was a sensible solution. Bell Labs was the creative arm and as I said, you know, sort of the brain trust for developing all the innovations in communications that Lucent would then build. So putting those two together worked very well. Bell Labs had a history of being sort of almost an ivory tower organization, an organization that you know, didn't necessarily respond to the demands of the marketplace because AT&T hadn't needed to. AT&T was a monopoly. I think by putting Lucent, a commercial company, together with the research lab, it allowed the research lab to become more focused and to create the products that customers really demanded. So I think it absolutely did make sense.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Lisa Endlich. She's the author of the book Optical Illusions, Lucent and the Crash of Telecom. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it takes a look at, as we said at the beginning, sort of the rise and the fall of Lucent Technologies. At one time, the most widely held stock in America that once was really a high flyer at the point where a lot of people in the investment business and even people who were just thinking about where they want to put their money thought that telecommunications was a sure bet, and didn't take too long before the company crashed. However, I guess the good news, I suppose, if there is good news, is that Lucent did not crash and burn completely. And in fact, this fall in October, the company reported its first profitable year since 2000. So that's it may be some testament to the people there who were running the place that they managed to keep the company from going down completely.
They did. You know, I think the importance of looking at Lucent is because, in my mind, Lucent embodies the sort of cyclical crazes that we've seen through the entire time the stock market's been in place. I mean, Lucent really is the story of the railroads in the late 19th century. Lucent is the story of 1929 and the trusts that were formed. Lucent is the story of any stock market mania in which people get way ahead of themselves in terms of valuations when they begin to fear that they will miss a profit opportunity rather than fearing that they could suffer some losses. So the importance of looking at Lucent is partly because the telecom and communications industry in this country is so important. But in a larger context, it's important to learn about these companies and learn about their experiences and learn about the roles they played so that we don't see stock market crashes like we saw in 2000 with increasing frequency. And I think that's what's important to look at. Now, to get to your point for a second about Lucent's profit, Lucent did turn a small profit this fall. And while that is definitely good news, I think we need to put it into some sort of context. Lucent was a company with 160,000 employees. Lucent is now a company with 30,000 employees. So it really is almost a shadow of its former self, and it's been able to make a profit on a much, much smaller base to a much, you know, smaller customer base. And while that's all very good news, there are still people who've lost their savings, you know, lost all their investments, their retirement accounts, and certainly their jobs in the crash of Lucent.
Well, what is your bottom line assessment of the decisions that were made by Lucent management, and whether, in fact, what happened was inevitable or could have been avoided?
You know, it all along the way, as Lucent was rising at sort of a manic pace, as the valuation of the stock became greater than anybody could justify in any reasonable manner, the CEO of Lucent, as well as the board, considered over and over again whether they should almost step off the merry-go-round, in the sense that they had continued to promise their shareholders 20% growth on what was at that time, you know, a $35 billion company. This kind of growth was really unachievable, and they were quite worried about whether it was possible. But they, like everyone else, got swept up in the times and continued to promise growth that really wasn't possible. So, no, I don't think it was inevitable. I think that if they had faced some of the facts at the time that Lucent really didn't have the growth possibilities that they continued to promise, they might have saved themselves some of the pain and agony that later followed. But, you know, it takes a very brave soul to stand up in the midst of a mania and say, I don't believe this is going to continue. And nobody at Lucent did that.
Mm. I think you make an interesting point. I think in some of the corporate booms and busts that we have seen, the fingers are often pointed at management. And we say this is a case of corporate greed, and we put the finger on the CEOs and the COOs. But I think that you also, as you say, you really have to take into account pressure from investors and stockholders who expect enormous returns, and they expect them over a very short period of time. They're not willing to wait. Now, you could fault management for buckling into that kind of pressure, but at the same time, I think you have to say, but that pressure is there and it's real, so investors have to share part of the burden.
Yeah. In this case, that's completely true. Investors need to share part of the burden. The competitive environment that Lucent was functioning in, the growth that we were seeing in places like Cisco and Nortel and some of their major competitors, really dug deep into Lucent. In other words, Lucent really didn't have the possibilities for growth that it was promising investors that it could deliver. All sorts of activities were going on, not necessarily illegal, though there were some of those, but certainly skating the edge of good, sensible sales practices. Lucent was promising customers products that they couldn't yet deliver. They were giving enormous discounts in order to get the business in the door as quickly as possible. Things of this nature that were really overly aggressive sales practices that in a more sensible time would not have been done. The problem is Lucent had to keep up with these other players. So for them to say, look, we haven't got the growth, you know, we can't really do this, we're going to consolidate and go forward at a lower pattern of growth, the stock would have been destroyed, absolutely destroyed. So the CEOs of these companies are sort of boxed in by the competitive environment in which they exist. And many of the choices, the more sensible choices that they might have made, have almost been taken away from them.
One of the things that you write about in the book is the management, and obviously can make or break any company is the people who are running it. And one of the things that you note is the fact that while Lucent had some pretty talented people, they had a hard time holding on to them, and you know perhaps maybe the stars or at least one of the people that we all would have heard of who had worked for Lucent and then went on to greater glory was Carly Fiorina, who worked for AT&T and then later went on to run Hewlett-Packard. So she was a big name star, somebody who, you know, who knows what would have happened if she had stayed at Lucent, but she didn't. Was there a problem here with the company holding on to its best management talent?
Carly Fiorina was certainly a big loss to Lucent. Carly Fiorina ran the entire sales force for Lucent, so it was, you know, one of the most pivotal positions. And she was thought by many to be the heir apparent and a future CEO. The problem was Lucent had a very young CEO, so that timeline looked like it was going to be quite long, and Carly Fiorina went looking for another opportunity. One of the problems Lucent had was a cultural problem. Lucent was AT&T. These were people who were used to working in monopoly. Suddenly they're thrown into a highly competitive environment where their competition are places like Cisco, Silicon Valley companies that are startups that have a history of maybe 5 years that are run by very young, very dynamic people. In contrast, Lucent is an East Coast, New Jersey company that's run by the same people from AT&T that have been working there for 20 or 30 years. It's an interesting story. In one of the divisions, in the optical division, the guy running the optical division in Lucent had been there for almost 40 years. The guy who took over for him was younger than that. He was 35 years old. So he wasn't even born at the point at which this man had gone to work for AT&T. So Lucent had, in some ways, in many parts of the company, very almost stodgy, slow-moving management. The very heads of the company were quite dynamic, but in many divisions they had very slow-moving management who hadn't quite adapted to the competitive environment in which Lucent found itself and couldn't keep pace with the changes that were happening.
Well, we have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. The listener is in Charleston on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to sort of turn on.
Hello? Well, I guess we lost the caller there. Maybe that person would like to try calling back. I'm not quite sure what the problem is. Other people who are listening, however, you have questions, you can certainly call 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, perhaps staying with the subject of management for a little bit. When the company was created and they were looking for people to run it, the first CEO and then the number two guy who became the second CEO, these were two men, a man named Henry Schacht and Rich McGinn. McGinn had come up through AT&T, but he had never run an entire company. Henry Schacht was someone who had experience in management, but not in telecommunications. And it looked like he would have been the kind of guy that you'd like to have the public face of your company because of his experience. And yet, he had no experience in that industry. So they put these two guys together. And I guess with the idea that eventually McGinn, once he accumulated enough experience, would become, and as he did, would become the head of the company. Was their match, you'd say in theory, it looks like that's a combination that could work based on their experience and ability. Was that a good match?
Well, I think initially it was a good match. Henry Schacht had been the CEO of Cummins Engine, a company out in Indiana, and he had, as you said, a vast corporate experience in running a large publicly traded company. But the company he ran made diesel engines, and diesel engines really couldn't be further away from the sort of cutting-edge technology company that Lucent was trying to be. So while Schacht brought a lot of very important lessons about corporate culture, about mores, about values, about managing large corporate structures, he didn't really know much about how to run a high-tech company with very, very aggressive growth goals. Underneath him was Rich McGinn. Rich McGinn had worked for AT&T for years, and on paper you would have thought was the kind of guy who really wasn't going to run a high-tech company, but in fact had very ambitious goals and was probably very well attuned to the times. And while the two of them forged a very close bond and the two of them were able to work well together, there was almost a push-me-pull-you kind of tension between the men. And when Rich took over from Henry, he really brought a much, much more aggressive posture to running Lucent, which was a bit of a shock for the company that wasn't prepared for what he brought. So I guess to answer your question, yes, theoretically it was a great idea and it did work for a short period of time, but Rich McGinn had much, much more ambitious goals for the company, and when he took it over, tried to put those into place.
We're going to try, I think, again with that caller we had from Charleston here on line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question for your caller that kind of turns backwards what she's been talking about. If you were the CEO of the company at the time of the break-off or the spin-off of the company independently, what would you have done differently?
You know, hindsight is a beautiful thing.
It's always easy.
And it's always very easy. So I want to start by saying that because, you know, what's obvious to us in the vantage point of 2005 was clearly not obvious in 1996. I think one of the things I would have done differently, Lucent kept most of its top management from AT&T. Many of those people are actually still there these 9 years later. Henry Schacht believed very strongly that you should let people who had run the division inside AT&T have their chance at running a public company. I think that Lucent had entered a new era. I think Lucent had entered a different market with competitors, like I mentioned, like Cisco, like JDS, Uniphase. And I think I would have brought more people in from those industries on the board and in top management to try and run a very different company. Because Lucent promised its shareholders that it would be a cutting-edge, high-tech company, that it would no longer be AT&T. Yet it continued to try and run with the same board members from AT&T and the same management from AT&T. So I think my first step would have been to make a very aggressive change there.
Okay. Can you speak? I don't want to take all your time. Can you speak about maybe three or four other decisions that you would have made, and then I'll get off the line.
Gosh, no. It's an absolute pleasure. I think one of the things that Lucent needed to do, and they tried to do, but I don't know that they were as successful as they might have been, was to tie Bell Labs more closely into the manufacturing process and into the sales process. Even though Rich McGinn and Henry Schacht tried very hard to bring Bell Labs into the more commercial marketplace, to make it a less academic, less ivory tower type of organization. They had a great deal of difficulty doing that. And it may be because the model of having a large research organization within a multinational company is an outdated one. It may be that the model that Cisco's used, which is you acquire these small startup companies who have, you know, the cutting-edge innovation within those companies rather than trying to develop it all yourself, is a better model. But they continue to devote 12% of the company's revenues, and they weren't really getting, I think, the value for that investment. In other words, Cisco, who was out buying all these innovations, I think was getting more value from their investment than Lucent was.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Let's go on. We'll talk with someone next on our line number two, in calling from Spring Bay. This is right here, line two. Hello. Yes.
I bought AT&T stock back in the early 80s, and the reason I bought it was I thought Bell Labs was great research. And then when Lucent split off, I thought, well, this is great. I'll just hold on to it. Bell Labs is good research. Then I had heard that the reason that Lucent went down was that they had made the wrong bet on some kind of technology.
Yeah, you heard correctly.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Oh, pleasure. You did hear correctly. One of the problems that Lucent, and it was only one of the problems, you know, a company the size of Lucent doesn't decline 99% because of a single cause. But you are absolutely correct in what you heard. Lucent made a decision at the behest of Bell Labs that it was an optical system. It was a system that was designed to send messages down fiber optic cable more quickly. It's called OC-192, and I write about it extensively in the book because it's a very interesting decision-making process. Bell Labs did not yet have an OC-192 product, and they convinced the management of Lucent that the products that they had in place were all that the customers needed and that this level of innovation was not needed at this point and, in fact, wouldn't sell. Nortel had decided that this was needed, that the one constant that we knew about in technology was everything had to move faster and more information had to move through any means of communication. So Nortel aggressively pursued what was called an OC-192 system and basically took the market completely away from Lucent. And Lucent's products were quickly outdated. In a matter of months, Lucent lost an enormous share in the optical market, which was really one of their cutting-edge businesses. And that was, you're absolutely right, one of the triggers for their downfall. It was a product decision made at the behest of Bell Labs.
Hmm. Well, we're a little bit past the midpoint here. Again, other people who are listening, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call in. And again, I should introduce our guest, Lisa Endlich. She is the author of a recently published book that is came out, actually, I think last fall, titled Optical Illusions, Lucent and the Crash of Telecom, and it's published by Simon Schuster. She's former vice president and foreign exchange trader for the investment firm Goldman Sachs. She has also written a book about Goldman. It's titled Goldman Sachs, The Culture of Success. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just, we've touched on this a little bit, but again, it seems that what happened here to Lucent was the same thing that happened to a lot of companies. They grew very quickly. They maybe lost sight of what exactly it is that they were supposed to do, of the business they were in. I don't know that it's necessarily the case that has happened with other companies, that they actually ended up buying things that they really didn't know anything about. That can be a problem at a lot of companies.
Yeah.
But here that, you know, they went on a buying binge like a lot of companies went on buying binges. And essentially, maybe it wasn't such a bad thing at the beginning. But then they started taking bigger risks and they started buying companies that were really little more than just startups at the time. They had ideas, but they didn't have products. And it seems that they got carried away with this same kind of buying wave that an awful lot of companies did.
I think that's absolutely the case with what happened here with Lucent. I mean, Lucent, over a period of 4 years, bought about 35 new companies. And you can imagine the amount of research you can do on that number of small startup companies when you're buying that quickly. Part of why there were 38 companies, I apologize, part of the reason they were buying these companies so quickly was simply because Cisco was buying at the same rate, and you know, either you bought it or they bought it, and if you didn't get there first, you lost the opportunity. So some of it was a competitive environment that Lucent was in, caused it to acquire companies long before they knew enough about these companies. A number of these companies came to absolutely nothing. The products never sold. The entire operations were shut down, and the entire investment was a loss. So that happened in many, many cases. Another way that Lucent got ahead of itself was in lending money. Lucent often lent money, small amounts, AT&T had done this in the past too, to their customers in order to build their infrastructure. So in other words, Lucent would lend its customers money, the customers would then take the money and buy Lucent's product. Now, that's fine when you have a customer like Sprint, who has their own large customer base, who pay their bills every month, and they have a revenue stream, and they will pay you back over time. What that's not so terrific with is when you have small startup companies that have no revenue stream, that are really not in operation yet, and may never really come into being. And Lucent's, this is called vendor financing, and Lucent's vendor financing, when it started out, was about $150 million, a very small amount of money in the context of a very large company. By 2000, Lucent had $8 billion in vendor financing commitments. Now, they didn't pay all these out, but they had made commitments for that much vendor financing. Many of the companies they had promised to lend money to never made it. They no longer exist. They went out of business, and these loans went bad. So that was another place in which the company very much got ahead of itself in the sort of mania of the late 1980s.
Yeah, that's amazing when you talk about these numbers. That was billion with B that you were,
yes,
the figure that you used there. And I guess that ultimately what the company did was they had to write off hundreds of millions of dollars,
exactly,
in debts because they had offered that out, you know, put that out, and just there was no hope that was going to come back.
Sure. And to give you some perspective, Global Crossing, which was one of the large startup telecom companies of the 1990s, at one point owed more money to Lucent than they did to J.P. Morgan, their banker. So Lucent had strayed, as you mentioned in your question, Lucent had kind of strayed from their purpose, from being the telecom equipment provider that they were to being a banker, really. And it wasn't something that they knew a whole lot about.
Yeah. The company, the buying binge that we've been talking about before, was certainly fueled by the concerns at Lucent, competitive concerns about other companies that they were competing with, among them Cisco. And apparently it was the pressure to compete with Cisco that led to what you, I think, argue in the book was the worst decision they made, the worst acquisition decision that they made, and that was buying a company called Ascend. What was behind the Lucent Ascend deal, and why was that a mistake?
Well, Lucent bought Ascend, a $22 billion company, in what was at the time the largest high-tech merger ever, in order to take on Cisco. The problems here were both financial and cultural. Lucent bought a company, as I said, $22 billion, and there's a very, very poor history for large technology mergers working out in terms of getting your value back for what you paid. But the issues, the biggest issue of the day was a cultural one. Ascend was a West Coast startup with a very brash, very kind of high-flying culture. Lucent believed in putting products out that were 99.9% effective. When you pick up the telephone, when I pick up the telephone, the dial tone is always there. That's not necessarily the same standard of quality that we find in the technology industry. I don't know about you, but my computer crashes more often than my telephone ever has or ever would, because the quality standards aren't quite what they are in the telecom industry. So Lucent bought a company that was much more footloose with both their quality, with the way they sold to customers, with the kind of deals they made with customers, and Ascend was a company with a very young sales force that had a very different style than Lucent. Okay, we take these two companies, we put this East Coast conservative New Jersey company together with this West Coast kind of brash high-tech startup, and the cultural mismatch really could never be worked out. The two sales forces could not combine. Each, you know, the Ascend people looked at the Lucent people and thought, you know, you're slow moving, you're not making enough sales, this conservative perfectionist approach will never work. The Lucent people look at Ascend.
Mommy?
Please get off the phone.
There's someone on the phone.
Please get off the phone.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I guess we have a snow day here.
That's okay.
We have a snow day, and I didn't realize my children were home. The Lucent people looked at Ascend and said, we would never do business like this.
Yeah.
And the $22 billion that Lucent spent, by and large, ended up being a waste in investment, because when you buy a company, you really buy the people, you buy the talent, you buy the minds, you buy the innovation, and none of those people stayed. So while Lucent still has the Ascend products, they lost all the talent that they bought.
Yeah. You know, that's, again, another interesting point, and I think that we can see that happening in other cases as well of mergers that didn't work out, that part of the problem at the root was that we were taking two companies with very, very different corporate cultures, different personalities, different styles of operating, and that they just didn't mesh, and maybe they were never going to mesh. And again, maybe that's one of those things where their hindsight will tell you that. And at the beginning, it doesn't seem that way. But you also have to wonder, would somebody have said, look, maybe it seems that in some respects this relationship looks like it could work out, but that we're too different and that maybe we shouldn't even try.
Well, there were people at the time. There were analysts and certainly commentators in the media and the industry who said, you know, this is absolutely nuts, that these two companies have so little in common. Anybody who thinks that they can meld them into a single entity, has completely missed the point. And in fact, they were right. So it isn't completely hindsight. People could see at the time that this wasn't going to be an effective transaction.
Well, I have, again, another caller in Charleston. Let's go there, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Charleston's just full of questions.
That's fine. That's good. I'm glad.
Would you speak to what became of Cisco? You're comparing Lucent to Cisco all the time. Seems to me that they didn't turn out too well either. And can you give us any idea about what happened to them? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, Cisco did, part of my book, the subtitle of my book is Lucent and the Crash of Telecom. The entire industry collapsed over the 2000 to 2002 period. So you're absolutely right in saying that Cisco didn't do too well, and of course, you know, the valuation of that company plummeted. But Cisco certainly fared much better than Lucent. I mean, Cisco was never in danger of bankruptcy. Cisco didn't have to get rid of 130,000 employees. It didn't have that many. Cisco's still an $18 stock. Lucent became at one point a 50-cent stock. Lucent teetered on the very brink of bankruptcy. At one point, Henry Schacht had to go to his bankers and beg them to make more loans to Lucent, because Lucent was actually going to fail if it didn't. So Cisco really never got into the dire straits that Lucent got into, and part of that is because Cisco was selling products that fared better. They were selling things that were more what the marketplace was demanding than what Lucent was selling at the time, and Lucent was much more closely tied into the telecom industry. Cisco was selling product way outside the telecom industry into what they call the enterprise market, large corporations who need communication systems, not just telecom carriers who need communication systems. So Cisco's customers fared better than Lucent's customers, and the effect went into the company.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, just let me quickly introduce our guest, Lisa Endlich. She's the author of a book about Lucent, its rise and fall. It's titled Optical Illusions, Lucent and the Crash of Telecom. It's published by Simon & Schuster. She's a former vice president and foreign exchange trader for the investment firm Goldman Sachs. And the book is out in bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I, taking a couple of steps back earlier in the story that we're talking about, that I thought was really fascinating, and perhaps you can talk a little bit about, is the point at which the company hadn't formally been launched yet, and the managers were in place, at least some of them. And what I think is interesting here is having a view into the point at which a company is in the process of being created. They're actually sitting around and saying, well, what is it that we're going to do? What is this company going to be? And I think that that's really interesting. And I'm sure that that's also not exactly an easy point to be at when you're literally trying to make up the company, decide, well, what is this company going to be?
you know, it's a chance and an opportunity very few people ever get. Mm-hmm. Most companies, you know, when you take over the management, they have a history, they have a culture. There's a lot of predetermined things already. But Lucent, as you're right, as you mentioned, was really at a very unique point in history where AT&T spun them off and a group of managers, about 16 of them, could sit around a table and say, what and who are we going to be? You know, what markets are we going after, and you know, how much into the international market, how much the domestic market, and what is the culture of our company going to be? What is it going to feel like to work here? What are people going to say about their experiences of working at Lucent? And it was also a point of controversy between Henry Schacht and his successor, Rich McGinn. Henry Schacht felt very strongly from his experiences as CEO of Cummins Engine that you need to pause, that you need to leave the day-to-day work that you're doing, and that you need to create a set of values and a culture that you're then going to live by. And if you don't do that, the company will run amok. Rich McGinn felt very strongly that while that is important, Cisco and Nortel and Alcatel were not sitting around gazing at their navels trying to decide who they wanted to be. They were out beating the bushes for business. And if Lucent, you know, took its eye off the ball for a period of time and tried to contemplate its future, they would slip behind, that the market was too fast and too competitive and you just simply could not afford to do this. So this tension existed between the two men who ran the company, one who at the time was the CEO and one who at the time was the president, as Henry Schacht tried to get his managers to focus more on an introspective point of view, and Rich McGinn, who had felt all along that AT&T had been too self-absorbed, that one of the problems with AT&T's culture is that AT&T had looked inward too much rather than looking outward at the competitive industry that it was facing, and that AT&T had fallen behind by not looking outward enough, did not want Lucent to take the same focus. And the two of them had, you know, really pulled at their top management, trying to get each trying to get their way in terms of this setting Lucent off into the future. Another point about, you know, the point of departure, Lucent, under Carly Fiorina, and completely, you know, it was completely her bailiwick, embarked on a $100 million advertising campaign as soon as Lucent was launched. No one was going to know who Lucent was. And even though you and I couldn't really buy a Lucent product, we weren't really going to buy an optical switch. It wasn't something we were going to, you know, go down to Walmart and pick up. We were going to become shareholders. You know, the average mom and pop were going to become shareholders of Lucent, and they had no idea what Lucent was. And her theory was that if she didn't, through an aggressive advertising campaign, tell people who Lucent was, they would sell their shares. And so she initiated a $100 million advertising campaign to give Lucent the new, brash, young, outgoing image that she hoped the company would take on. The interesting thing about this is that, of course, the employees are watching this. The employees are watching the print advertising and the television advertising. And as Lucent is polling their own employees, they're finding out that their own employees' vision of themselves is changing by the advertising the company is doing, which I think, you know, speaks volumes as to the power of advertising. Mm-hmm. You've worked someplace for 10, 15 years, they start advertising, and your vision of your own company begins to change. But it was so powerful in terms of recreating Lucent's culture, or an attempt to recreate Lucent's culture, the advertising that they did at the initial stages of the company.
We have a couple of more callers we'll try to get in before the show ends. We'll go next to, they're both in Champaign. We'll go first to line number one. Hello.
Hi. Is it possible that Lucent didn't even know really all the assets they had? And by that I mean they spun off Avaya, and whereas Lucent tanked, Avaya has become a very, very profitable company that's really the worldwide leader in voice recognition technology and it's making a bunch of money, and Lucent struggled ever since they spun it off.
They spun off two companies, or they spun off and sold many things, but the two main important ones are Avaya, as you mentioned, and Agear, which is the second one. Avaya, yes, I absolutely think spinning off Avaya was a critical mistake, and it was driven very much by the 1990s. Avaya was a steady and still is, you know, revenue-earning company for Lucent. Year in and year out, Avaya made money, but Avaya didn't make money fast enough. In other words, Avaya was a company growing at, you know, 5 to 8%, steady business, the kind of cash-generative business that you should want. But if you've promised your shareholders that you're going to grow by 20%, Avaya is dragging you down. So in one sense, you're absolutely right. They did sell off what was a prized property, but it's because Avaya couldn't perform at the late 1990s standards.
Call, does that get at your question?
Well, and I think that does. Although Avaya now is selling for 18 and making 70 cents a share, and Ajir, of course, has been they sold it off at $6, and it's like $1.50 and split, you know, two different stocks and done miserably poorly because it's a chip company.
Yeah, that's actually a turn of fortunes because Ajir was really the stronger business when they were both inside of Lucent.
And Avaya is just a monster company in their field. I mean, they have long-term steady potential that's going to make it a real strong company in the next 10, 15 years. So.
Yeah, but long-term steady potential are the exact words that nobody wanted to hear in 1998. People wanted to hear fast, huge, rapid growth. Not long-term, not steady. Those are words that maybe this century are moneymakers, but that isn't what people wanted to hear in the late 1990s.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to line number two. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello. Let's call it there, line two. Perhaps not. We'll check back, and if we can get that person in, we will do that. Otherwise, if someone wants to call quick, we can get you in. Just one other piece of the story here. We're talking, you have touched just now and a couple times on how much pressure there was on the company to perform and to make money and to make money fast. And that pressure came from Wall Street, it came from investors. Then the management put that pressure on its sales staff. We talked about the problems that the company got into with vendor financing. What other sorts of problems were the result of this pressure on the company that then the management put on its sales staff to just make as many sales just as fast as you possibly can?
You're absolutely right, describing the culture that had descended on Lucent and the entire industry. You know, one of the things that happened was Lucent salespeople began to cut all sorts of deals, some of which were later retracted because they'd stepped over the boundary of legality, but many of which were just ill-advised. You know, Lucent's time horizon went from being maybe what a company should think of their 2 to 4 year hit time horizon to 1 year time horizon. Lucent's time horizon got down to about 6 weeks. In other words, it was more important to make a sale now, you know, today, sitting right here, at some huge discount than to wait, you know, 3, 6, 9 months to the point at which the customer really wanted the equipment and would pay full price for it. So Lucent was trying to get its customers to buy things the customers neither really wanted nor really needed at huge discounts just to get the revenues on the books. And, you know, next month, 6 months, a year from now, those times will come. And when you've sold everything you can sell, as aggressively as you can sell it, what are you going to sell then? So basically what they did is they pulled sales forward into the current quarter just to make whatever the current quarter was, and they basically robbed their future. And this all, you know, it's a house of cards, and it came tumbling down in January of 2000. Mm-hmm.
We talked about the fact that in the fall, the company reported the first profit since 2000, although modest, and as you said, it's not the company that it once was. It's merely a shadow of its former self. But having said that, it is a company that managed to survive, maybe in reduced circumstances, but did survive. I guess I wonder what you think of the company's current CEO, Patricia Russo, and how she contributed to the company's to the fact that now, at least in the fall, they were reporting profits.
You know, Russo, I think, is a very, very strong manager, and she's a very different kind of manager than Rich McGinn, who was the CEO that Lucent kicked out in 2000 for not meeting his quarterly targets. Russo is the kind of manager who will grow a very steady business in a very conservative yet effective way. She's not going to aim for the stars. She's not going to swing for the fences in the way that Rich McGinn did. And in that sense, she's a much more appropriate CEO for the times. She is obviously managing a company that's a fraction of the size, but she has a knowledge of this business that goes back to her own 20 years at AT&T. So I think she's a very strong, very effective manager. I think she's managing the right company at the right time. I think she might not have been the right person for the 1990s. That kind of crazy mania really didn't suit her very well, but she's a perfect manager for the times and the company she's now managing. But I just wanted to add one other point. The real importance of looking at Lucent now and the real importance, even though the crash happened 4 years ago, is that the effects of this sort of thing are lingering. One of the nicest things about writing a book is the opportunity to go out and speak to people about their experiences and to meet so many people all over the country. And the overwhelming sense you get from people is that while the sharpest moments of pain are over, people have lost their jobs, they've lost their savings, that the pain really lingers on. You know, Lucent had an older workforce than some of these other companies. So we're talking about people in their 40s and 50s and 60s who were never going to get the kind of high-paying jobs they had at Lucent that really took advantage of their skills and their education, because those jobs no longer exist where they are. And so it's important for us, I think, to look at these companies and look at these stock market crashes, because while the immediate crash may only last 6 or 9 months, the pain certainly lingers on much longer than that.
Would just overall, we have here a story. Part of this is the story of what happened in an industry. Part of it's the story of what had happened in a particular company. Are there overall lessons that transcend what happened just in, that may connect with what happened in Lucent, but also transcend what happened in Lucent, that tells you something about corporate boom and bust?
I think there is. I think the most important lesson to walk away from Lucent and from telecom is that each time we as an investor community, we as an economy, have believed that something is different, that everything we know about valuations, everything we know about growth, everything we know about the best ways to run a company, every time we decide that something is different and that everything we have learned about those things no longer is important, every time we believe that this time it's different, it isn't. In other words, the arguments were that the Internet made everything different. The Internet created a completely different communication system so you could speak to customers in a way you never could before. The Internet allowed us to have just-in-time valuation. Do you remember the argument in the late 1990s? There would be no inventory buildups. Because of the Internet, because of computers, we would have just-in-time inventory. Mm-hmm. We would never have large inventory buildups. Well, the largest ever inventory write-off happened in 2001 and 2002 with JDS Uniphase. I think they wrote off $56 billion. So all the excuses that we make to describe why this time is different, when we begin to use those words, the first thing we should be thinking is maybe it isn't different. Maybe this is the same story again.
Well, there we'll have to leave it for folks who want to read the book. Again, it's titled Optical Illusions, Lucent and the Crash of Telecom by our guest Lisa Endlichs, published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Support for the broadcast today comes from Scandinavian Link and the Old Farm Shops Champagne, featuring all things Scandinavian, including Auckland linen, Baltic amber jewelry, Norwegian sweaters, traditional foods, and Brio toys from Sweden. The program also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. They're pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Right now, we're going to hand things over to Celeste Quinn for the Afternoon Magazine. She'll take you for the rest of the afternoon. Big weather story today.
Indeed, and Sam Klein will join us at 12:35 this afternoon. He'll have all the up-to-date information, and also at that time we'll give you a list of closings and postponements and cancellations, that kind of thing. So that's coming up this afternoon, 12:35.